sure many of you remember him as a wide receiver in the conference when it was the Pac-10 for Stanford, played in the NFL, Browns, Eagles, Seahawks. You can follow him on Twitter. Use the handle at EvanMoore89. Evan Moore joins us. Evan, appreciate the time. How are you doing these days?
I'm good, thank you. I appreciate you having me on. It's always good to jump on and talk some ball.
Yeah, you know, considering what's happened here with Oregon, you might be the perfect guy to ask. I mean, this program had remarkable stability with their coaching staff for decades, and now a third coach in 3 years. When you started with Stanford, it was Buddy Tevens, then Walt Harris, then Jim Harbaugh. What do you remember about you and your teammates? You know, it's a bit of upheaval to deal with.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I, you know, drawing comparisons to my time at Stanford, it was very similar, obviously. Like, when you have that kind of turnover in this sport, I'd say more so than any other sport, because there's really no quick fixes in football. You know, it's, I know some guys can bring in JC guys and whatnot, but basketball, you know, if I'm making a comparison, you know, one or two guys can totally change the direction of your program. But football is, you know, you got 22 guys in the field and you got all special teams to worry about, so it's difficult with a lack of continuity and a different message that guys are receiving each year to make progress. And it's not just at the head coaching position. It's also at the coordinator positions as well. We've seen other teams in the Pac-12 have issues from a lack of continuity at those positions too. So, you know, I thought when Willie Taggart got there, Willie was at Stanford when I was there. I liked Willie a lot. And I thought, you know, they had gotten a guy that was going to be there for a long time. And I was wrong. He was there for 1 year, and he moved on. But I think Oregon's in a really good spot right now with Mario Cristobal, and I think they have the guy for the foreseeable future that's going to lead them to more and more wins. Because this team, I'll tell you this, like, if this is a culmination of it, this team is playing as physical a brand of football as I can remember Oregon playing for a long time. And they got away from that for a while, especially after the Chip Kelly era entering the Mark Helfrich era. So I think there's a lot to be excited about if you're an Oregon Duck fan.
Well, they're certainly excited in this town. And I got to do a little throwback since it's the first chance we got to chat with you. I mean, you took part in maybe the biggest shocker in the history of the conference. 11 years and 5 days ago, Stanford, a 40-point underdog at USC. I mean, at that time, you guys had one win. You had, you know, you struggled in three conference games. The teams were all ranked, UCLA, Arizona State, and Oregon. What do you remember about knocking USC off right in the midst of their dynasty?
Yeah, that was Harbaugh's first year, and so that was my senior class. That was our last year, and we had been through a lot. I mean, like you said, we had, you know, this is our third head coach, and a lot of losses. The previous year, we were 1-11, and so what I remember vividly is that off season, as you may remember too, Jim Harbaugh basically called out Pete Carroll and the Trojans, and it got a little bit of attention because of Harbaugh's name, and I think generally people kind of dismissed it, but since it was Harbaugh, they said, oh well, you know, we'll see what he does, and you know, as a team, we're like, well, we're the ones that got to deal with it, Coach. I mean, you know, you can run your mouth all you want, but we're the ones that have to go out and deal with it. And he just injected a sense of belief in that group because we knew that we had talent on that team. I think if you ask anyone that coached against Stanford back in the mid-2000s, they would admit that, okay, yeah, they didn't win many games, but that was a team we always were concerned about. We always had a lot of talent, but we just didn't have the continuity. And so that game, We were there the entire time. We were hanging in there. And then I remember that last drive very vividly. It was fourth and long. Richard Sherman converts on a seam ball down the hash. And then we run three plays on the goal line. One of them went to me, and I ended up stepping out of bounds before coming in with the ball. And then the very next play, we run the exact same play, and they end up going to the other side instead of to me, to Mark Bradford. Mark makes the play. And as a 41-point underdog, we get a win at the Coliseum. It's definitely one of the coolest memories I've had in you know, my football career, without question.
You know, I saw you did the podcast with John Wilner, and you were talking about targeting, how it should be applied. You know, there was the hit on JT Daniels, the quarterback of USC, by Logan Tago of Washington State. So it's roughing, but not targeting. Then in the booth, it's targeting and in the command center. And then there's the Yahoo story. Today, Larry Scott admitted a procedural error. I mean, how concerning should fans be about hearing stuff like this?
Yeah, you know, I thought Larry Scott handled it really well today. You know, the mechanics of these calls, as I explained on that podcast with John Wilner, there's a lot going on. And at the end, John asked me, he said, if you were the czar of officiating, what would you do to improve? Because, you know, our assumption at that point is they just missed the Port Augustine call, the non-call. We weren't even talking about the one on JT Daniels. And my reaction to that was, hey, John, honestly, like, you know, from where I stand, I just think we need to I like the rule when we talk specifically about targeting, but I just think we need to continue to improve the communication between the on-field officials, the replay officials that are at the stadium, and then also those at the command center on game day. And to insulate those people from any other outside factors was my comment at the time, not knowing that there might be even more than we realized. But, you know, given the command center is relatively new, this is year two of using it, I'm not surprised there's some wrinkles and things that they have to iron out. And I applaud Larry Scott for addressing those things head on today and, you know, hopefully correcting those issues as we move forward. And once again, insulating those replay officials and those on-the-field officials from any other factors that really should not be involved in what goes on the field. Because ultimately, just want to get the call right. That's all they want to do. That's all of us fans want to see them do is just get it right. And whatever it takes to get there, they got to do. But they got to keep that process as credible as can be moving forward.
Talk with Evan Moore of the Pac-12 Network. By the way, as a receiver, somebody who goes over the middle, goes airborne, I just found that I'm sure that you took a lot of this personally. You also said something I found really interesting, why would we know this, that the Pac-12 briefs analysts about the new rules each year. So if you were to describe to fans maybe what you learned about targeting and what we should be looking for, you know, beyond the obvious launching and headshots when the circumstances arise.
Well, you know, I think every analyst does get a chance for every network, gets a chance to familiarize himself with the rules more so than the average fan because it's our job to explain things that happen in front of us on TV. But at the Pac-12, I think one of the big advantages we have is we get a chance to talk directly to David Coleman and those that, you know, we just get, extra attention on the rules, which I love because I love to learn more about the rules as they change. But this penalty, in my mind specifically, this foul, if you will, I like the rule. And I think if you're the type that thinks that it sets football back and that football is it's making football soft, I think it's totally misguided because I don't think this does anything to that. I think ultimately it's just trying to get rid of hits in the game of football that are completely unnecessary, and it's trying to protect defenseless players. And then also from a launch standpoint, it's trying to protect players from themselves. I mean, that launch, the one using the crown of the helmet, that has as much to do with defending the defensive player that's actually committing the launch as it does with the guy that he's making contact with. And so, you know, the NFL is taking measures as well to protect players because what we've learned, and I think players have even admitted this, retired players from the NFL, is that players at times need to be protected from themselves. And I don't think we knew 15 years ago some of the damage that this game puts on players that play the game, like maybe we're learning that it maybe shouldn't be played. And I don't want to see football totally change and turn into flag football like a lot of people are hinting at. I don't want to see that. But I do think there's a happy medium to make this game safer and take some of these headshots out of the game against defenseless players without question.
All right, let's get to some of the specific teams. Stanford, who had climbed into the top 10, you know, they suffocated USC. They looked beaten here, rallied. And then, you know, the last two games just were very non-Stanford, particularly on defense. Minimal pressure on the passer, getting run on for big yards. What are you seeing that's allowing teams to kind of, especially the last three, to move the ball so consistently on them?
Yeah, you know, coming out of last season, that was a concern going into this year. You know, the best player on their front seven last year was Harrison Phillips, and he was drafted in the third round by the Buffalo Bills, so he's gone. But if you look at Stanford's front seven last year, they allowed about 160 to 170 yards a game on the ground, and they struggled at critical times to stop the run last year. And I didn't see them adding anybody personnel-wise this year. All they did to me was subtract Harrison Phillips, and so I would say going into the year, the front seven was a concern. It played better than we expected earlier in the year, and I think that's a result of playing some offenses that turned out to not be quite as explosive as we thought they would be. Obviously, Stanford held SC to 3 points, and that seemed like a win. And I came out really impressed that their front seven was playing that well, but then they go against the best teams they faced all year in Oregon and Notre Dame, and I think they allow a cumulative or a combined 69 points against those two teams, and those teams more or less had their way on the ground against that defense. So I think, you know, this linebacking group is deep. I don't think there's anyone that really is special, per se, like they've had in the past at that position. And I think they're struggling to hold up front. Like we kind of thought in the offseason, we kind of thought this would be an issue. And now that they've hit the teeth of their schedule, we're seeing it kind of manifest itself a little bit more. And then offensively, they're just not possessing the ball like they have in the past, and they're not kind of imposing their will on teams, and so the defense is finding itself on the field more than it has in the past. And the philosophy of the team has shifted a little bit, too, because they're forced to throw the football a lot more than I think we're used to seeing Stanford throw the football. So when you're losing consistently on both sides of the line of scrimmage, you're not running the ball offensively, and you can't stop the run defensively, it's really hard to win games in college football, and I think we're seeing that with Stanford right now.
Talking with Evan Moore of the Pac-12 Network, you know, in that podcast with John, you mentioned something very specific about the running game, and I thought from an analytical point of view, fans would really appreciate it, because we see numbers, and it's like, they're not running the ball well. But you mentioned that it's specifically the play calling and where they're running is where they struggle.
Yeah, well, I think one thing that, you know, coming off last season, the only starter they lost was David Bright. And so personnel-wise, we figured that they were pretty airtight. But one thing I think we've discounted a little bit early in the season is they also don't have Mike Bloomgren, who's their run game coordinator from last year, who now is the head coach at Rice. And Mike's been the guy there, I think, since 2011. So he's been a consistent voice for them in the run game, and he teaches things a certain way. I think they miss his presence. But then on top of that, they've had some turnover up front. They've had some guys injured. Daniel Marks, their fullback from a year ago, is not there anymore. And then their best tight end in the run game was Dalton Schultz. He's also not there. And so often when we talk about run game and lack of success in the run game, we immediately go to, oh, well, the offensive line must not be doing that well. It's the same thing in pass protection. The fullback in Stanford's offense, where you see a lot of two-back runs and tight end runs, the tight end and the fullback and how they fit into what Stanford does offensively is critical. And not that those guys have underperformed, but you take all those factors, the lack of Mike Bloomgren, some of the issues and injuries up front, and also losing some guys at the fullback and tight end position, I think it all comes together for the perfect storm and a lack of success up front. Because, look, Bryce is the same guy. It's not like Bryce all of a sudden lost his talent. I mean, he still put up some numbers, but this is the same guy that's just not getting the holes he got a year ago, and they're going to have to find a way to fix it soon. And I know David Shaw will find a way because this is their philosophy. A lot of people want to see them become this pass-first, spread-it-out type team, and I don't blame David Shaw. He's had a ton of success resting on what that run game does and the identity of that team, and he's not ready to abandon that right now. He wants to get this fixed and get their run game right.
Really interesting stuff. Obviously, a lot of eyeballs on Chip Kelly moving to UCLA. Unlike when he took over here in 2009, he took over a really stable program that had just won 10 games. Now the landscape of the conference is different. The previous coach was fired because he didn't succeed. And they played a little better last week against Washington. But what's your read on what he could accomplish and, you know, get that program turned around and maybe how patient to Bruins fans need to be?
Yeah, that's a good question. I know Chip, obviously, you said it. I mean, he inherited a 10-win team, you know, his first year in Eugene. I think that matters because I think he inherited a pretty talented team when he went to Philadelphia as well with the Eagles. And so we've really never seen Chip in this capacity as a program builder, like building from the ground up with all these young guys. And I think the jury's out on how successful he'll be doing that. Now, I will say, they've showed remarkable improvement over the last couple games, and I think you see a lot of young guys, especially that quarterback, that are they're playing more consistent ball and playing better football, and that's encouraging. They played their best game of the year this past week against Washington, and I do think they're going to get a win this year. It's very difficult to lose all 12 games, and I think they'll find a way to get a W. But that roster he inherited, now there's a lot of highly recruited guys, but I think with UCLA there's a culture issue. A lot of these guys that were 4- and 5-star recruits that Jim Mora brought in my mind, it's almost like, I dealt with this at Stanford, it's almost like an infection that spreads amongst some of the upperclassmen where the development just has not been there. And I think you can probably point to the Mora regime for that. And a lot of those guys, unfortunately, their time may have passed in Chip's eyes, and he may think, you know what, I got to focus more on these young guys. Because I know for me, when I watch that team play and I think how young they are, I'm like, well, you got all these upperclassmen that are 4- and 5-star guys that Moore has had there for a couple years. Like, why not try to develop those guys? But I get where Chip's coming from. He's thinking more towards the future, like some of his recruits, some of these younger guys, and developing them. Because sometimes, unfortunately, some of these upperclassmen that really just haven't had any success and haven't developed, it might be too late. And I think if you're Chip, you just can't risk putting your eggs in that basket. You got to get your young guys on the field and start to develop the guys of the next generation of UCLA football players. So he's got his work cut out for him. He's got all the resources he could ask for. He's right in the middle of Westwood. There's no reason he doesn't recruit well, just like Mora did, and I think he's going to develop players better than Mora and build a winning culture. It's just going to take time.
Couple final thoughts for Evan Moore, the Pac-12 Network. We know Washington, Oregon Saturday. Really the first time since 2000 that they both are playing here with a lot on the line. And we live in what I call the duck bubble, so it's nice to get an outside view. What do you like about Justin Herbert? And, you know, this is the top defense he's faced so far, and maybe what this unit is capable of doing against Washington.
Right. Well, I'll tell you, I love Justin Herbert. I'm going to join the chorus on that one. I mean, he's an outstanding football player, and I'm blown away in person by how big he is, too. And you pair that with his athleticism, his accuracy, his arm strength, his touch. I mean, the guy's a complete package. Now, I look at Oregon as an offense, and I see an offense with a head coach that, you know, offensive line, run game type head coach, that really wants to run the ball. They run it about 60% of the time, and that's a heavy run distribution. But what seems to be their calling card, outside the fact that they run it as much as they do, is they are an explosive passing team. I mean, I look at, they're second in the conference right now with 35 plays over 20 yards this year, and 27 of those are through the air. And that's the difference maker for them. I mean, they're so efficient when they decide to go through the air with Justin. You know, he'll finish games with not even that many completions and just a ton of yards. So they do a really good job of taking advantage of the big play. Now, the interesting thing that matchup-wise this week is they play a Washington team that just doesn't allow very many big plays. I think they've allowed like 12, 20 or more yard plays on the season versus the 35 that Oregon's gotten. So something's going to have to give because that's secondary. And I'll tell you this, the other thing that's really impressive about Washington, they really don't get to the passer very well this year. I think they have 8 sacks on the year, and none of them are from outside linebackers, the guys that are up on the line of scrimmage. So for them to be as good against the pass and not get after the passer like they've done this year tells you how good their secondary is. So I'm really excited to see that matchup between Dylan Mitchell and company and that Washington secondary because, again, something's got to give. Like, Oregon needs these big plays to stay alive like they've done most of the year, and Washington just hasn't given them up. And so we'll find out, you know, just how good Justin is and where he's at right now from being elite like we think he is, because he's going to face a defense that on the back end might be the best in the country.
And lastly, I know John pinned you down to pick the winners in both divisions, but after another week, we've got another opportunity to kind of add more data. So in the North, from Washington's chances to win at Autzen, then the Huskies play the Cardinal in Seattle. I don't know that you can overlook the Cougs right now. Basically, what's your evaluation of this North race?
Well, that's a really good question. I think, you know, as it relates to Oregon and Washington, this is huge for the North this weekend because Oregon, I think the winner kind of takes control. I mean, if you're Washington, you win, you take total control. And
right.
If you're Oregon, you take control based on the fact that you have the tiebreaker with Washington and all the teams have one loss. But I still lean back to what I told John. I think at this point, Washington to me is the most battle-tested. I think Oregon's a really good football team, but their non-conference schedule was really soft, and their Cal win is what it is. Yes, they should have beat Stanford, but they didn't. And so until they take a team like Washington down at home, obviously coming off a bye with a really good opportunity to do so, I'm not ready to jump on anybody but Washington right now in the North. I think they're the most complete team from top to bottom, and I think they're going to be the toughest to beat. So I can't wait to watch it, though. I know people in Eugene aren't going to be happy to hear that, but this is it's a really tough one to call, but I am going to be glued to my TV at 12:30 on Saturday.
All right, awesome stuff. He's Evan Moore on Twitter, at EvanMoore89, breaking it down for the Pac-12 Network, Fox Sports as well. Evan, really appreciate your time and unique insight. Thanks for joining us, and we hope to catch up again down the road.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on. Really appreciate it.
All right, take it easy.